I did prepare some remarks for today, but how marvelous to just listen, huh? That mountain over there is called Storm King. I don't know how it got its name. I'll have to check that out. But there's wonderful, wonderful storms here. And I hope that everyone here enjoys the sound. I know some people have some issues with the sound of thunder. If anyone here can't hear me, they would be welcome to come sit up here. Yeah, just bring your zabaton too. I don't know, this is the end of a 10-day session for me. My energy level is a little low. I can't project like I usually do. I've got some water in my ear for some reason too, which distracts a little bit. I will speak up. There's a woman, a Chinese Buddhist, who was roughly contemporaneous with Hakuin. She was the abbess of a nunnery in China. And I've spoken about her a few times because I like her a lot, Xingang. She wrote a poem that just struck me the other day. I was kind of trying to find what else was going on when Hakuin, I think stimulated by Shinryu's talk, what else was going on in the world at that time? And Xingang was over there teaching many people, men and women, students, Zen. And she wrote a poem about the Buddha bowl. The Buddha bowl is the largest bowl you have in your Orioki set. And traditionally, the only thing that goes in there really is things that are given to you, food that's given to you, and rice and your sustenance is there. And also you would take that same bowl in the old days out and people might put some money in there or things that you need in your Buddha bowl. So it becomes a very important part of your traveling materials. You have your Buddha bowl and your robe, and theoretically that's all you have. Of course, if you've ever traveled with a contemporary Zen person, you realize that they have twice as much as a lay person. Never mind. Anyway, here's Xingang's poem. The Buddha Bowl. How very elegant it is, with not even a single leak or hole. When thirsty, I drink. When hungry, I eat. Leaving not a crumb. I understand that once washed, nothing more need be done. Yet how many lost souls insist on attaching a handle to it? Yet how many lost souls insist on attaching a handle to it? And we have this bowl. And it's very elegant. Doesn't leak. Has no hole in it. It allows us to drink and eat from it. And we can wash it and it's all clean again. So why would I want to turn that into something I'd call a teaching? Why would I want to fix a handle on that and turn that into something else than the experience of the Buddha bowl itself? What vessel is it that gives us our sustenance? You know, we say of samadhi that there's no leaks. When you have really good samadhi, there's nothing leaking out. So what I think the handle does, it separates us from the Buddha bowl. The handle Buddha bowl separates us. The name Buddha bowl is a handle that separates us from this particular cup, which has a quite kind of unique markings on it by our Dharma holder Myoko, one of her cups. Calling that thunder is a handle. Thunder. What's thunder? Marvelous sounds. I think our one handle that sometimes we may not be aware of is the handle that is formed by our society, by our culture, by our language, just by the language that we have inherited, that we grew up with. And in a way, that's so embedded in our mind and the way our mind works that often we don't recognize it. And I think in a way that may be one reason why some of us are drawn to a different form, like Zen, because the language is different and fresh. It doesn't come with a lot of baggage. It doesn't sound like my grandmother. But below the surface, these concepts are still entrenched in our minds. They're still embedded under the surface. And very much part of our under the surface language, I think, is embedded the idea of sin. I have two ministers in the audience, so I have to be very careful what I say. But I've been reading a book by Paul Tillich, the Protestant theologian, and I was just very struck because he talks about sin as separation. He talks about it in three ways. There's the sin, there's the separation that we have from ourselves, and then there's our separation from one another. And then there's that huge separation from what he calls the ground of being, which we might call Buddha nature. And Tillich posits that our separation from the ground of being is what creates our experience of separation from ourselves and from others, from each other. So you could think of it, if you thought of it in our terms of what we've been talking about all week, and Hakuin's terms, our separation from our Buddha nature creates our separation from ourself, because we have to reject that which we think is bad, rather than realizing that that entirety of our experience is our Buddha nature. And we also reject in others. So coming from that initial separation or rejection of the ground of being, of our Buddha nature, we ignore reject and cannot accept the reality of our lives. So, following on that, so Tillich is not seeing sin as an act, but as a state of separation, a quality of being that is separated from others. So those of you who will be doing the precepts next week might want to consider that. You know, how easy it is for us to take the precepts as commandments or potential sinning opportunities. And instead, look at the state of our mind at the times that we fall into grasping or rejecting. Look into the state of separation. I see separation as the immediate cause of an unskillful act. That's what inclines us to say the nasty thing, to do what we know better. And that's people who are living a life of conscience. Many people are not even aware of the motives that are pushing them. So we've been hearing about the same kind of thing from the speakers during this wonderful sesshin. This separation from the self is one theme that I've heard very much from the beginning. Myoko, Chodo, and Koshin spoke much about not being connected to one's inner life, one's past, and what it is that motivates one. That separation. Or Ryoshin, when he talked about his childhood fears, so much like Hakuin's. In a way, he was healing in the moment of expressing that to us. If you could feel that. Just as Chodo, when he talked about his frustration at a bag being left on the street, was in fact in the act of healing that in his expression of it to us at that time. Removing the separation and coming back. That. I was particularly struck by Anraku's continuous repetition of remembering, not remembering, but remembering, re-embodying the trauma and suffering that she experienced as a child growing up in an all-black neighborhood, the only white girl in the school, the preacher's kid. Not an easy thing for a child. And to go back and walk down that street was an act of courage and an act of healing, an act of bringing back together that which was separate. Bringing Anraku of the now back to that child that was traumatized. It's hard to put back the broken parts of ourself where we are separated from our experience, separated from our history. You know, Anraku's story made me realize, oh, well, that's right. I grew up in a convent with I was the only English speaker from the time I was like in first grade till I was in sixth grade. Everyone spoke Spanish everywhere except in the classroom in which we spoke English. And so there was that quality that I was the gringa in the group. That the separate one. Also, and it's something it's not part of my narrative, I dropped that one out, but Unraku brought it back in, that sense of strangeness, of otherness, of not being part of the group, which is so painful to a child. So this going back and entering the place of pain, the place of suffering, the place of trauma, in order to heal the separation, is very much like many of the atonement ceremonies that we do. Atoning for our, what we call evil karma, what we chant every morning, coming back. We remember, revisit, re-embody. We remove the separation. And this is what Tillich calls grace. I love that word, grace. That which dissolves separation, leading to unity. I always think first when I hear the word grace, I think of the three graces, the Greek three graces. Charm, joy, and beauty. Something that has a quality of ease, of lightness. And the Latin word gratia, meaning pleasing. Just pleasing. Charis in Greek, that which delights. So in Tillich, sin is separation and grace is the reunification of it, coming back. And I, of course, have been thinking all week about Satori and Kensho, the words that we use in our tradition. And Ryoshin remarked that I don't talk about that very much. And it's true, I don't use the terms Kensho or Satori. Some teachers, every Dharma talk. And yelling in the Zendo. Kensho this and Kensho that. I'm trying to refrain from giving you a handle. Sometimes I talk about Buddha nature a little too much. Hakuin speaks of the bright moon, the bright, clear moon. The Soto school treasures the hazy moon, the moon that's, you can't quite make out its edges. Sometimes one and sometimes the other is good for us. A beautiful, bright, sunny day, cloudy, rainy day. Which is better? But this concept of, Hakuin talks about Satori. He has many Satoris. And Satori means understanding. That's what it means. That's the literal translation. A lot of times, we mean by that enlightenment, and by Kensho we often commonly mean kind of the first experience of breaking through. But as you read Hakuin, you see he has many, many Satori, so I think it's closer to say that that he also understands it as understanding, having an understanding, having a realization about one's nature. So I like the idea of just for the, not forever, but just for the duration of this talk, thinking of grace as an aspect of realization, of what this concept of bringing what is separate together. Mostly we have been talking or the other speakers have been talking about our separation from ourselves, which is, you know, very Western. But there's also our separation from one another, how we interact with one another. And I was having a conversation with someone in Dokusan about, you know, how hard it is to come here and be with people. And I said, oh, well, you know, Zen, most of the Zen people I know are loners. Most of us are like terrified of being in community. It is the worst aspect of coming. And maybe that's one reason why we gather in this kind of strange way where we all get together in very close quarters where we have to wait in line for tea and we don't speak. But we do speak. We just don't speak with words. But we're here and all our stuff is here too. And it's a wonderful time for us to notice the arising of separation, is to notice how these things come up, and they are, if we're really clear, we can really see that they are really little stories that we have, that we tell. And there have been some misunderstandings during this session, and of course, guess who gets to hear about all of them? And what came to mind was the story of Othello during this. I remember reading this essay many years ago, The Tragedy of the Handkerchief, right? If you know the story of Othello, he is this wonderful, noble, beautiful man, and a great prince from Africa. And he marries Desdemona. And there's a bad guy in the play, and Iago, who arranges a situation so that Desdemona's handkerchief is given to this handsome young officer. And then that's used as evidence for Othello to think that Desdemona has been cheating on him. And so Othello kills Desdemona. The Tragedy of the Handkerchief. And of course, she did not give Cassio that handkerchief. And it's rather like that during Sishin, because we have these things happen, and people, you know, make up these stories, and it's kind of, and I do too, we all do it. It's not like I'm saying this person does it, but all of us do it because our minds are like these story-making machines, these narratives. And we're kind of, because we're not talking to other people, they're kind of like, we want to get caught up in that. We want to make a story about everything. And it's very, very helpful and instructive if we can just stop for a moment and see what we're making a story about, and who's the victim and who's the perpetrator, and on and on. Because that's where the healing will take place. We take a look at that separation, that widening gulf, that other that will never get away from the teapot so that I can get some water. That fool. And then coming back to that. Heal the separation. It's so important. I remember my first retreat. I went to Auschwitz three times. I like to call him Rabbi Bernie, but you could call him Roshi Bernie if you prefer. But Bernie Glassman, has sponsored these retreats at Auschwitz for many years, and I went for 3 years. My first one was so powerful. It was the first one that we did, the Zen Peacemakers. And there were about 200 of us, people who identified as victims or children or loved ones of victims, and then those who identified as children or loved ones of perpetrators. So large German and Polish contingent, large Jewish contingent. And then a bunch of us who were, for whatever reason, needing to go there and bear witness. So we were kind of like second level. The power of that was extraordinary, extraordinary. The coming together. And people told stories, got up and told stories, and as they were telling stories over and over again, it became really clear that the syndrome of the child of the victim and the syndrome of the child of the perpetrator was the same, the alcoholism, the child abuse. You know, the next generation, both sides suffering incredibly from the same things. Right? And then Rabbi Don Singer, who is a Roshi in our lineage. He's got a temple out in California, in Malibu. And he's a wonderful, wonderful man. He's a singer. He has a beautiful voice. And he started singing, and he brought us all to our feet. And I don't remember if it was Havana Gila, but something that everybody would know and be able to sing. And we joined hands. I'm talking about 200 people, right? And started dancing around and through the auditorium and then out into the lobby and then out. And now, mind you, we are inside Auschwitz concentration camp. There is barbed wire. There are memorials everywhere. And there is all the skeletal structure of Auschwitz is there. And we are singing in Hebrew, holding hands and crying. It was the most amazing healing I have ever experienced. It was phenomenal. It was so beautiful. What happened is that there was grace, that separation dropped away for those moments when that was going on. And it was extraordinary. Brought together the pain and memories, the fear, was all brought together in that moment. Extraordinary. That which was broken. Now, of course, the next day there were many people who thought it was an inappropriate thing to do. And we had counsel about that. I mean, naturally, there will be some that were not able to do that, were not ready, could not open. It's hard. Next week we have our annual Hiroshima Memorial service here. Inevitably, there's someone who says, well, are you having a Pearl Harbor memorial? I mean, it's so entrenched within us. It's so important to pay attention to that and work toward the healing of that. I don't even think people realize, or I don't realize, that there is a possibility of grace until I recognize that I'm separated. As long as I think that I am right, that this is the way it is, that this is the true story, there's no possibility of grace. I have to do something. I have to open in some tiny little way. I thought Ryotan's haunting image had haunted me all the following day, of someone playing solitaire in an air-conditioned room. I mean, it's heartbreaking. It really is. It really is. Alone, cold, isolated, only the sound of a machine, distracted by a game. that person is in me, wants to be alone. It's in all of us. And we have to recognize that, so that grace, Satori, can help us to reunify back to ourselves. Hakuin's realizations, as someone, I can't remember, I believe it was Shinryu, talked about the first realization, strong Satori that Hakuin had, and afterwards he was just like this arrogant asshole. And he was like, you know, I got it, and look at the rest of the world, right? So he's very dramatic, Hakuin. He was a brilliant genius, a fantastic calligrapher, painter, writer. And so it's not surprising that his expression of his Satori would be so colorful. That was the way he was. But that's not why I love Hakuin at all, actually. All his language and so forth. What I love about Hakuin was his humanity. Despite all this yelling and screaming about the fox slobber of this person and so forth, he was really something. If you read Wild Ivy, you'll see that time and time again he's doing something that he desperately wants to do in his life. And he's feeling like, yes, this is it. This is what I'm meant to do. And suddenly he's pulled away by the needs of someone else. And he always goes, and he doesn't complain about it. He is practicing at one point. He finally found a teacher he really liked. He doesn't say much about his first teacher, but one has the sense that that was dramatic and probably the source of a lot of this yelling and screaming. But he finally found one he really loved, Shōjō Roshi. And he was working really well. A bunch of fellow fanatics there, and they were all practicing hard together and in a very kind of very butch way. And he was so happy. And then someone comes by and says, did you know that your old teacher, Nyoka Roshi, is very sick? And Hakuin doesn't say anything. He just packs his bag and goes back to Shōinji to nurse his teacher, his old teacher, that he hasn't seen for 10 years. Without any complaint, without any question, he goes and takes care of him. He leaves this fertile environment where he finally felt that he was really maturing. Later, after Nyoka, some other people come to take care of Nyoka Roshi after about a year, and so he leaves and he decides to go on pilgrimage. And on his way back to nurse Nyoka Roshi, he had seen this beautiful hermitage, and he had thought, this is what I want to do with my life. This is what I would like to do. And but he goes back to that place, and the place is all torn down. He can't stay there. And he can't find the right place, and he's looking and looking. He's going from temple to temple, and he's asking teachers after teachers, where can I go and go to a hermitage and really, really see myself, really practice? And finally, he's told about this old hermitage on Mount Iwataki. And he's so happy about that. It's so marvelous. And he actually gets some help. Someone helps to carry a gigantic bundle of rice up for him so that he'll have a handful of rice to eat every day. And he begins a simple hermitage life. He was ecstatic, finally able to practice utterly, as he wishes, he says. And he settles down and he thinks, this is the life for me. This is what I want to do with my life. And then, an old man, an elderly servant of his father's, appears and says that the tiny temple where Hakuin first practiced, Shoenji, is falling apart. No one taking care of it. Destitutes, rats are going in there. You can't walk from one part of the temple to the other without rain falling on your head. And that Hakuin's father, who had given money for that temple initially, although they were not a wealthy family, but he had given money and had been a major supporter of that temple, was very upset and had sent this old man, his servant, to go and fetch Hakuin to come back to this dilapidated temple. On the high road, on a very frequented road. So poor Hakuin, here he is in his happiest place, in his nirvana, packs his robe and bowl, and follows the old man back home. The place is in terrible repair, he says. And so he decides to build himself a basket out of green bamboo and sit in that. So he's still, like, he's got this, like, fanatical quality, right, which we love. He's going to do that. He wrote, here at this post station on the eastern high road, so this was like the road between Kyoto and Edo, and it was a place where people would stop and rest for the night and so forth. So it was a very busy, it was like an intersection, right, in the world. Here at this post station on the eastern high road, an island floating amid the defilement of the world, surrounded by the hectic intercourse of rich and poor, the clamorous strife of right and wrong, the din and clatter of men and beasts constantly moving to and fro. Who would have believed me if I had told them that life in such a setting was fully equal to the delicious solitude I had known among the cliffs and crags of Iwataki, far from the world's dust? Sound like 1108? The din and clatter of men and beasts. And as he sits there for a month or so, he realizes that he can't just sit there in his beautiful green bamboo cage. That I must, quote, devote my energy to liberating the suffering beings of the world by imparting the great gift of the Dharma. So time passes. One monk comes. Three monks come. The community down the hill is taken care of when memorial services are required. More people come. Lay people come. People write letters. He spends the rest of his life there, not in some major temple in Japan. The rest of his life is there at Shoenji. And it's far away from the major temples. And eventually there's over 150 monks. And when he's 80 years old and riding wild ivy, he says he still goes where people ask him to go for the teachings. And then in this really endearing little part, he lists the places he goes to give the talks. And he lists the topics of the talks and the texts that he's studying and giving to others. It's just so marvelous, so beautiful. And he says, I still go when someone asks me to go and teach. to devote his energy to liberating the suffering beings of the world by imparting the great gift of the Dharma. So this is a different side of Hakuin than the obvious one that we're attracted to. The one that's yelling and screaming and getting our attention. And underneath there's this hazy moon here. Among his works is one that I particularly like, and that is his letters to a Nichiren nun. He gave a series of lectures on the Lotus Sutra, and a Nichiren nun wrote to him, and she was concerned about his understanding of the Lotus Sutra and some of the things we can just imagine what he said. And he wrote a letter back to her, which has become very treasured in the Nichiren tradition, as well as in the Zen tradition. And it's a long letter, and I won't read that. But I want to bring out some elements of it that I think are helpful to our practice and to us as we began to wind down the Sesshin. He tells her that the meaning of the Lotus Sutra, and he said, quote, cannot be seized by the hands nor seen by the eye. How then is one to receive and hold to it? What then should one say to the practitioner of the Lotus Sutra who wishes to take it to himself? So, reading that, I think, what can I say to the Zen students about how to make the Zen work for you? You know, how, so much time in Dokusan is about trying to fit your Zen into your life, you know. Trying to find the moments where you can, quote, practice. So we lose sight of the essence of it. So, he tells her there are three types of practitioners. The first type, and now we're talking about Nichiren Buddhists, of course, are captivated by the yellow scroll with its red handles. And this person copies and recites and makes explanations of the Lotus Sutra. A more average practitioner will gain insight by studying the Lotus Sutra and thus use the sutra in their life. But he says the person of, quote, superior capacity penetrates the sutra with his Dharma eye as though he were viewing the surface of his own mind, penetrates the sutra with her Dharma eye, just as though she were viewing the surface of her own mind. The sutra is no longer a useful teaching, but it is the person's own mind. There's a world of difference between the two. We enter Zen practice and smell of incense, the aesthetic, the nice flower arrangements, the smooth ashes, the robes, the poetry, the calligraphy. It's really cool. It's like those handles on the scroll. Then there are those of us that learn a lot about ourselves from Zen practice. Yeah. Aha! I see this about myself. And my relationship gets better because I see this about myself. My game gets sharper. I'm confident and clear. It's true. It's all good. It's average. But it's good. But the deepest level of entering Zen practice is taking it, just as Hakuin talked about the Lotus Sutra, as the surface of one's own mind, so that you and the practice are not two. Not to. He says, quote, "Once a person sees this true face of the lotus, then coughing, swallowing, waving the arms, activity and quietude, words and actions, all plants, trees, tiles, stones, the sentient and non-sentient, all manifest as the sutras of the wondrous law. And throughout all the hours of the day, harmonize deeply with the sutra." So there's nothing that is not Zen. Then he says, if you try to hold the sutra without truly seeing it, or we would say try to hold our Zen without integrating it thoroughly within us, we're like a person who holds a bowl of water perfectly still, does not want to spill it, just holds it day and night, never drinks out of it, just holds it. But he says, but the person who sees the true lotus is as if he had poured this one bowl of water into rivers and lakes everywhere. At once it merges with the 36,000 riplets, and its beneficence joins with the waters, so that all the creatures that leap, run, fly, or crawl come to drink at the same time. This water would never be exhausted. So the difference between holding and sharing and giving off and manifesting. How we do it in our own life. By our actions, our gestures, our thoughts, every aspect of our being, not by talking about practice, but by manifesting it, really manifesting it, making it grow. He tells the story of two brothers to make the same point, but just slightly different, that I want to end on. He tells the story of these two brothers that are called Mr. Chang and Mr. Chang. Chang Wu and younger Chang Lu. They decided to seek their fortune, and they went out together on this long journey, and they found a bar of gold. And they split the bar of gold, and they went off in separate directions. And many years later, the younger brother was worried about the older brother and was looking for him, and heard that his older brother was in another town, and he went. The younger brother had become very, very poor, poverty-stricken, was wearing a dirty old robe, and was essentially a beggar. And he went to his brother's place, and his brother had this huge properties. And Hakuin goes on for pages and pages with the flocks of geese and the sounds of the flutes. And I know that you can't hear all this right now, but he was amazed at the opulence of this of his brother's possessions that reached everywhere. And many people that were occupied and engaged in agriculture and in crafts. It was this incredible place. And so he asks to see his brother, and his brother rushes out and throws his arms around him and says, "Oh, you know, how are you? I'm so good to see you, but what's happened to you? Why you look like a beggar, and you're dirty and ragged?" And the younger brother says, "Well, I have not lost the golden bar." And he reaches into his ragged old cloth and takes this dirty handkerchief out, and there is the half of the gold bar that he has kept and held this whole time. And he said, "And where's yours?" And his brother says, "Oh, a few minutes after we left, I gave mine in exchange for a bunch of salt. And then I sold the salt and got some silk floss. And then I made some silk garments, and blah, 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 blah." And Hakuin says, that's like studying Zen under a teacher. What you obtain at first is the nature that you innately are endowed with. We all have that bar of gold. But what do we do with it? Or I would say, here we are. We found this magnificent practice. What are you going to do with it? Are you going to hold it? Hide it? What are you going to do with it? We don't know how we affect others. We have no idea. We have to make Zen us. And then everything we do is an offering. Yesterday, the housekeeper, Mora, came over to the Hermitage and just to do a little business. And she said, I don't know, it must be the Zen people or something, but I was looking at the sky and it's so blue. Rodney, maybe you could ring the bell.